Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 122nd episode of the Manor Podcast. I'm your co-host, Roger Bodie, joined as always with my best friend and other co-host, Michael Hamilton. Michael, I know it was recently established that one thing in after your top eight of Worlds that you were the GOAT again, but now are you and Michael Fung both the GOATs? Are you co-GOATs? Are you comfortable sharing your GOATed title with another Michael?
Yeah, I'm down to share my title with Michael. We can both be GOATs.
Do you feel comfortable being a GOAT, Michael Fung?
I think Michael Hamilton is the actual GOAT. The fact that I can be in the same sentence is already flattering.
That's fair. Okay. So you obviously had a very successful weekend at the Calling in Portland. So Enigma was the deck of choice. Do you want to talk about how you wound up on Enigma for that tournament?
I think I was pretty set on playing Enigma.
Yeah, you've been
even before Worlds. I knew that I was probably going to play it at Portland. I joked about it with, I think, Michael, with Hamilton, that when we were like testing for Worlds, that like Worlds is just practice for Portland. And that's kind of like the mentality that at least Brody and I have had, like, honestly, for the last like year and a half, 2 years, which is like there's always another tournament. And like, while that tournament that we're playing right now is important, like we're constantly learning, like the mistakes you make at Worlds, the things that you learn at Worlds, you can apply them at the next tournament, even though it's smaller stakes, even though it's like not as prestigious. This idea of like constantly learning, constantly improving is, I think, one of the ways I attribute to our success. And I think, I knew that I was going to play Enigma there. I didn't know which pile of Enigma cards. I remember I spoke with Hamilton. He's like, I don't know, I'm just going to play a pile of Enigma cards. They banned my blue CYBs.
Yeah, that philosophy about every tournament being like practice for the next tournament, that's actually a big part of what got me to pull the trigger and register CYB new at Worlds.
That's too awesome. So that's awesome. That. Yeah, yeah.
Because I think you said it, you're like, well, it's just kind of practice for Portland. I don't remember exactly what you said. I'm like, yeah. True. All right, I'll do it.
Yeah, but Scar for a Scar in Enigma, though, was your idea, right, Michael?
At Portland, I had heard people... Well, you said Michael. I think that was talking to me.
Yeah. But
at Portland, I heard people say they'd seen Scar in Enigma before. So I don't know if it was an original idea, but it was... I thought of it as an innovation that I made. I hadn't seen it before. And I'm like, what if we just put Scar in this deck? And yeah.
Okay.
I messaged Michael like, I think two days or something before the tournament started. I think I was playing games with Brody on Wednesday. And I'm like, man, I just need to kill your Viscerai deck. What about Scar? And I messaged Michael. I'm like, can we put Scar in Enigma?
Yeah, I didn't say no. I was like, I think it's like, for me at this point, I've tried like almost everything with Enigma, and you didn't have to tell me twice why you were putting it in there. I knew, you didn't even have to tell me that you were playing against Brody, because I knew the context. Like, Brody was in your vicinity, so he was in your domicile, so he was probably making you jam games with him. And I just like understood like all the nuances of what putting Scar in Enigma meant, and also what like how you like playing the game in general in Flesh and Blood. Which is often a lot more like tempo and value oriented. So I was like, yeah, I think, especially for you, I think it just like made so much sense. And then I chewed on it for a long time because, as Enigma now just feels like the onus is on us to like kill people, because everyone's kind of ready for us to like play a mirror guy at this point. Most of the top decks they have an answer. They don't always have an answer, but they like their whole game plan is having an answer. And like, we can't just ride a dragon to victory. Although sometimes you still can.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to build your deck around protecting your auras. And a lot of the decks that are doing well are very good at killing your auras, even when you're trying to protect them. You spend four or five cards to protect your auras and their last hit gets through. Or maybe you protect your auras, but you don't have Tunic counter up to swing with it. So they just get another turn to try to clear them again. And maybe you can't defend them on the next turn. I always thought just like killing them is better than trying to protect your stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And Enigma has a lot of good tools, like Phantasmaclasm, even like Miraging Metamorph. We have these, we borrow from Illusionist class all these like above rate, although they do have Phantasm attacks. They're very good at whacking opponent, especially if we know that they don't have any poppers or have very few.
Yeah, and especially when you lead on like an aura, and a lot of your auras have go again, because that's just they have plus one counter. So you lead on an aura and then you attack with Phantasmoclasm. You can kind of mess up their hand a little bit. And then even if their hand blocks for more than it attacks for, they don't really want to block when you have an aura in play because then they're not clearing your aura.
Yeah. It's like true damage. That's the Enigma like secret hidden mode, is we have true damage once we play an aura down.
Yeah. It's an interesting form of evasion, but it works.
Yeah.
Okay. So did you want to go like round for round, like what you wanted to, or how your tournament went?
Yeah, sure. I can kind of blitz through this. Round one, I played against Jesse Keenan on Leviah, who he and I have history, actually. When I played Lexi into his Leviah, I don't remember which tournament this was, but he took 9 Blood Debt on stream from a Beast Within against me, and I barely beat him. Like, I think if he took 6 Blood Debt, I would have lost, to let you know how lopsided that game went.
Wait, it's not Blood Debt. It's like the pings from...
Oh, sorry, not Blood Debt. Yeah. He lost 9 life from Beast Within, just flipping 8 cards that didn't have, that weren't sixes.
One Beast Within was 9.
Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy. but he just like played so well on stream. Like, he got max value from his Husk, and like, I thought he was going to let his Husk pop that turn. Instead, he just blocked perfectly to the point where his Husk did not pop that turn. And then he got, it was just like, he played so well, and I barely won because he took 9 life from the Beast Within. And I think our game was kind of like how most of my games would go. I had a really lucky run this past weekend. I have a turn where we're both at 25, and I have a Scar for Scar in my hand. And I think I also have like a sink or something. I don't remember. I end up not sinking because he just goes claw. And I'm like, I'm at 25. He's at 25. So I'm going to go to 22. And then I go to Scar for Scar, and I have like some board or whatever. And I'm like, oh, that's fine. I just like lose this little part of my board, but I still have some go again. And it's going to be so good. And then he loses 4 life from Blood Debt. He's like, go to end step, lose 4 life from Blood Debt. I'm like, wait, what? Now he's at 21. And I'm like, oh, I have to like chain end of Scar. But I mean, that was like one of the reasons that we liked Scar. It's like, when you're behind, Scar is great at catching you back up. And when you're ahead, like, you're ahead.
You're ahead, and sure, a lot of time it's still good enough. Yeah.
As a chain ender, it's a 0 cost card that we're unembarrassed to play. I think one of the things I thought about when you mentioned Scar was how many times I've been playing Essence of Ancestry Mind as a chain ender, or Spectral Prowler as a chain ender, just because like I have too many cards, like my opponent, whatever, for whatever reason. And I was like, wow, this is so much less embarrassing than those two cards. I think for this weekend, if all my Scar for Scars were standing orders, I would have had a better I don't know how you can have a better tournament, but like I would have like won harder or whatever.
You because were just I winning ended up, too much.
Yeah, I ended up blocking with Scar almost every single game because I was always ahead in life. But that first round, when Jesse lost that 4 life to Blood Debt, that was just like how a lot of my tournament went. Just like these really fortunate little things to me, like not like insane blowout things, but just like little things going in my favor. Yeah, that game was just kind of sad. I think Jesse basically never drew a Blood Rush until, like, when he drew the Blood Rush, it was, like, such a big life discrepancy. I was in full send me the bill mode, and then he was low enough that I was just, like, playing any ward, was taking cards from his hand. Round two, I played against Matt Schubert, and I have a really funny story about this. I was in Colin Florence 2 weeks ago, Italy, and I played against Matt. And we played in a side event, and he was playing Aurora, and I boarded in my just normal, what I think Aurora, a good board against Aurora is. And the first turn of the game, he pitches a blue Wreck Havoc to make a rune chant. And I was like, what did you just pitch? I was like, okay, I can see this being like, you know, like of all the blues, like this could be okay. Yeah, he ended up being, I guess we call it somersault Aurora, which is like not a concept we haven't tried before. We've tried somersault in every single lightning hero because it's just such a cool card, but not very good into Enigma. I think he on turn 4 or 5 just said, would it be rude if I concede because I have like a spectral shield of 6 counters, and it's just been every turn is just starts with 7 go again, and he's just like block 6 somersault these two like I saw like Weakest Link, Amnesia, Wreck Havoc red, Findle's Fighting Spirit Rainbow. Like that was the type of deck he was playing into it. And I don't think he had actually really played against Enigma ever. Like it felt like his first or second game. Fast forward to Portland, we play again. I mean, he knew that I was going to Portland. He told me that he was going to Portland. So we both knew that we were going to Portland. And I match against him. I'm like, this is insane. I can't believe I'm like, the world is so small. And I'm so scared that he's just going to be normal Aurora. I still board the same way, which really means I kept in Phantasmoclasm, because that card is terrible against his deck. Like, the first time I Phantasmoclasm him in Italy, he had three poppers in his hand. I was like, I guess we'll take the blue. Yeah. But yeah, he just played a very similar build. He said he innovated like changed nine cards just for the Enigma matchup, which included Sloggism, both red and blue, Pummels. And they were not good enough. I Phantasmoclasm in one turn, and he was like, I don't want to show you my hand. His hand was like Sigil of Suffering, Pummel, Sloggism. I don't remember the last card. Maybe it was another copy of one of those. But it was just, yeah, it didn't go very well for him. It was probably the easiest round I had in the tournament, just because I had familiarity with it. And I just drew, like, the turn he went CNC for 12 with Sloggism. I have 4/3 blocks, and my Tunic is going to 3. And so it was just like, things just went so well for me. Round 3, I play against this guy named Tater. And I have another funny story. He, on turn two, pitches a yellow Biting Breeze. And it immediately sparks this memory of mine, because I had played some Talishar games with Enigma that week. And I was like, dude, I played against this deck on Talishar on Tuesday. And he was like, no way. Were you Enigma then? I was like, yeah. And he was like, did I kill you with 2 Salta Wounds back to back off a really large Y turn? And I was like, you did. And he was like, and I was like, I told him my account name on Discord was I Am Grat at that time. And he was like, dude, I played against you. And I was like, what the heck? The world is so small. But because I had played against that version of Ira, which is really close to Fi, like, it's basically like head jab that deck. You can get away with playing yellow Biting Breeze and yellow, like just like some of the yellow ninja cards, because like the Ira ability could kind of buff them, or you just pitch that card to Ira. So it was like very similar to Fi, but I guess you can get that +1 more reliably. But we changed the deck. Like, we played the Clasms, the Miraging Metamorphs, just like more attacks, and just trying to basically race in an aggro race. And it felt like that was a really effective strategy into that style of Ira. I just honestly probably ninja in general. And yeah, I ended up winning that game because he did not double Salta Wound me. Like, one Salta Wound is fine off of the hat, but like double is when it gets like nutter butters. You have two cards that are worth like I think his against me on Talishar was like an 8 into a 9, which is like, yeah. Yeah, it's good math. It's good math. Round 4, play against Wyatt, who's also an IR. He ends up beating me. I don't think my deck drew very well, and I do think he played extremely, extremely well. I do think that matchup feels overall kind of Enigma favored, just because of our numbers, just because the chances that Ira can draw a brick. Some of the bricks are basically no blues, too many blues, no go-again attacks, too many go-again attacks. Like, it's just like, there's the percentage of hands that don't work well feels pretty high. But I did end up losing that, and I do think Wyatt played really, really well. I really like the inclusion of Pouncing Paws as tech, just because the turn I played Mirror Guy is the turn he cracks Pouncing Paws, and it makes it so that he has basically Kodachi for 1, Pouncing Paws for 1, Kodachi for 1, literally anything else. That's already kind of annoying. He mentioned that Dense Blue Mist would be good kind of like tech against that type of strategy, but I think I should have just let the Mirror Guy die to 1 damage the moment he represented the Pouncing Paws for 1, because he's trading his legs for my Mirror Guy. Hopefully I make another one later. I don't think I played perfectly, and I don't think I realized how good of tech that was. But yeah, that was a really good game. And then I ended up playing against an Acilia after that. Her name was Anemone. It was so cool. I love that name. Probably my favorite game of the weekend, just because they really like played that deck so perfectly, but they had this one turn cycle that was just depressing. Like, I had some type of board, I attacked with it, then I ended up in Phantasmoclasm. Think for a while, let me see their hand. It's a Somersault and like 3 Sigils. And then I'm like, oh, we'll bottom that one. And then they draw, and they're like, Acilio, a Somersault. Take 9, go to their turn, Acilio, Somersault. Really bad, really unlucky. Yeah, and then I played Enigma Mirror against Domki, and yeah, I think we kind of just, I just drew like the nuts, which honestly was, I levels of enlightenment and then transcended 3 turns in a row. And like, yeah, it's just, one of them was using Pathwell Travel, so I got all 3 modes. And the other one was using the spec, the Immortal Lunar Shrine, which meant I got all 3 modes again. And it was just like, he would attack me, I'd lose my board, then I would send my board. But I was not only clearing his board, but doing like above rate damage, which is not like not normal for Enigma. Like, we have Titanium Baubles, and then we have Levels of Enlightenment, Blues, and the Immortal Lunar Shrine. I felt like I drew so hot, and I ended up winning. And then I played against Jeremiah. He was on new, and I 40-0'd him. And that kind of felt like how the tournament went. You know, like, he just never could get clear everything. Every Siren's Call, I had, like, a waxing that I'd play. I'd show him two reds. It's just, like, kind of one of those games where, like, everything... Like, I don't think I, like, blew him out. It took, like, multiple turns. Like, my life pad has, like, three columns for him. And obviously, I'm just a blank. Because I don't even write 40 when I start. I just, like, the first time I take damage, I mark it down. I never wrote anything. But I had three rows for him, which meant he took a lot of bits of damage here and there. And went really long, but ultimately I got there. Felt pretty bad, but, like, that's some of the Enigma games do end up being like that. Basically, I started turn zero with a Restless Coalescence, or spec into Restless Coalescence, and that Restless Coalescence never died, and I Astral Etchings it all three times. So I just kept refilling the battery and pooping out shields.
Yeah, and then you have all the shields to just, like, eat the daggers that are hard to block.
Yeah, it was bad. I had D-Reacts when I needed D-Reacts, and just weakest linked him once, and it was, like, devastating, like, just things like that. Yeah, and then we go to day two. So I end X1, day one. I'm pretty happy about it. I did feel like I was, like, a little bummed about losing to Ira, to Wyatt. But, X1 is just insane. And kind of a funny story, I have been doing really well day one in callings that I've been playing in this year outside of the heavy hitters callings. And I have been wearing I'm not wearing it right now, but I have this, like, lucky gray shirt from Uniqlo that honestly is nothing special. It's, like, I think it was $15 and I bought it, like, 2 years ago, and it's been my lucky shirt. Like, I've done really well with it. And this whole year, it's always been my favorite shirt to wear day ones. And day two, I've been just basically just getting murdered. Like, I don't think I've gone 50-50 on day twos.
You should wear that shirt 2 days in a row, like, wash it.
That's what I did. So I was like, I don't know, let's try this out. So day two, I was going to wear a different shirt, but I just grabbed it from, like, the dirty laundry section of my, like, I don't know, I had a little drawer. And I was like, you know what, I'm just going to wear this again. And I wore the same pants I wore, which I've been wearing these, like, gray sweatpants, also from Costco. Not very expensive, not very special. But I wore them because I was like, I don't know, like, I keep doing well day one wearing this. Like, why don't I just try wearing them again? Yeah, and then that's what I ended up wearing to day two. And I start by playing against Justin on Aurora. I felt like, you know, it was like a stereotypical, all the things went right for me. I Phantasmaclasmed him. I believe he had two Flicker Wisps in his hand, or three. I don't remember the specifics, but it's just like, I bought him the not Flicker Wisp, and I think he blocked with two Flicker Wisps. And that was about how that game went.
This happened to me as well, where I was playing against a lot of Auroras that were doing the Flicker Wisp Arc Lightning combo.
Yeah.
The fact that our deck is just trying to kill people really quickly. I'm not even sure if the Auroras are supposed to be Flicker Wisp comboing us. How do you feel about that?
A lot of my losses, obviously not this weekend, but I have lost to that combo quite a lot, actually. In Florence, I played in a side event and I 0-2'd before I met Matt, the other Aurora. And I lost my round one to a guy named Bogdan, who Flicker Wisp comboed me, and it was just like, it felt kind of almost oppressive, the amount of damage output. So I actually don't think it's a bad strategy. I just think that by Enigma's being more aggressive gives you less time to find the combo, because he literally comboed me on the first turn of the game. Like, he arsenaled a card, and then the next turn I did raw, like, vanilla damage, and I went to, like, 17, because he just drew the other part of the combo. And I mean, it just does a lot. Like, it makes his was a, like, I think it was just Flicker Arc. It wasn't even Flicker. Like, I think it's really, really good when you get two arcs in there, because the arcs scale damage more than the flicker. And it's just like, I don't know. I was just like, I guess I'm below 20. I blocked my full hand. And next turn, I blocked my full hand. And somehow there's still a 20 life point discrepancy. So I don't think it's a bad strategy. I think it depends on your philosophy on the matchup. If you believe that you need to add more variance on the Aurora side, then I think it's, like, it's correct. I will say that I'm terrified of that. I'm way more terrified of that than seeing Crown of Providence and any other chess piece, like Tunic, whatever. Because if that's what I see, then maybe you're trying to more mid-range me. And I do think I can find more windows to win the game if the game goes long. And so if I feel that way, then maybe it is correct to to play the combo. It's just when I play the combo like equipment, I just feel so like every time I draw Flicker and it's just like it's not immediately time to go, or like there's a channel Lightning Valley in my hand, I don't have a lightning card and I have a Flicker instead, I'm like, it's just like a cracked bauble, and I just like it's not good for my mental health, but I am pretty terrified of it. And when it does line up, I feel like you do win the games much more easily.
Yeah, so. A lot of my I guess the reason I was wondering about it is Auroras don't usually play the combo in aggro mirrors, and I think against Enigma in general, it makes sense that you're playing a long game. It clears auras through AB1 very well, and it just does a ton of damage, and you get time to set it up because Aurora is pretty good at clearing auras. But I think our Enigma deck, I'm going to say our Enigma deck, I'm going to take partial credit, even though you won the calling with it. I do think it does feel somewhere between like an aggro deck and a mid-range deck with like the scars and just playing a bunch of above rate attacks.
Yeah, I definitely feel that way too. And I think like adding three copies of Scar is like not just one or two, but like three really kind of tells at least us how we want to navigate turns, where we're much more happier to like trade damage and just like, you know, get both of us into the danger zone. Because I do feel like Enigma is so much better if like both players start at 12 and we can represent 12 damage with Ward. The moment we're peeling cards and we're both playing into like three, it's so much better for the side that like has a weapon that's also like a health buffer. I think that was like one of the reasons why I like Scar, but basically at least against Justin, I at one point it was like I'm 17, he's 30, or I'm 32, he's 17, I'm drawing scars, I'm like sinking this away. I was really ahead in life totals, and I felt so bad because like he just drew so poorly. And I got to see what he was drawing, because every time I went down to him, I'm like, pick that guy? And he's like, yeah, that's what I thought you'd do. Okay, no blocks. He did make a critical mistake. One of his turns, he had Embodiment of Lightning, and he did not lead with, I think, a Lightning Surge. And he needed to do that in order to weapon. Instead, he led with, I think, Arcanic Shockwave, which makes sense in theory. The card has like the word Lightning on it, like four different places. But he realized right after, he's like, crap, I can't swing weapon anymore. So he lost like two points from a weapon swing. Ultimately ended up not mattering, but like little things like that, like lose some edges. And we talked about that afterwards. Yep. Next round, I play against Pete Boonsek, but he's an Aurora.
Nine. Huh? This is round nine.
Round nine. And I, okay, so before you and I talked about Enigma, we shared deck lists. I actually was not going to play Spectral Manifestations in my list
at all.
My theory was that you can use Astral Etchings with gloves in the matchup. You have gloves, you can board it out sometimes, or you just like activate Enigma, figure out a way to make a special shield like the old-fashioned way. For a while also Waning Vengeance could be your special shield. Instead I was just gonna play Spears of Surreality Red, and that's the deck list I ended up turning in. And it didn't have Spectral Manifestations at all. And I got an IP penalty before round nine. And I was going first. I have three cards in my hand. I say pass. Pete Boonsek plays Channel Lightning Valley, makes an embodiment. And I'm like, I had a Phantasmoclasm. He ended up taking five damage. And that was the last points of damage I did for the rest of the game. He kept that Channel Lightning Valley for two turns. I have three cards, so I can never block out his attacks. And he knows that. So he's basically playing five card hands into my three card hands, and I die basically the turn I get to draw four cards. I'm basically dead on board. I was at like five or six, and he just shows me Flicker Whisk. Doesn't even show me the rest of the combo, just does a bunch of damage, and I just cannot block it. Very, very swift defeat, to be honest. I didn't feel very bad about it. He felt bad about it. I was like, dude, I got an IP penalty. You played well. Like, yeah. Right? Like, you got to close the door when you can.
The IP penalty, they did let you keep the Spectral Manifestations in your deck, though.
Yeah, they were just like, what did you intend on registering? And I think whatever I said, I was going to get IP penalty no matter what, but they would at least like let me like fix the deck, basically. I don't know. I just said like I intended on registering Spectral Manifestations red because I wanted to have the same 79 or whatever with Michael Hamilton. I like, to me, that's like really valuable because it means like during our mid rounds, when we have questions with each other, we are like at the same, we come from the same footing. Like, I don't even like, I didn't really care too much whether or not those were the correct cards. they were like correct enough. And I've played like so many different styles of Enigma. Just knowing what's in my 80 helped me dictate how I want to play. And I was just like, there's like a lot of value in us having the same deck list. So that's why I wanted to have the same deck list. But I just forgot that I, on my printed out deck list, I had Spears and not Spectral Manifestations Red. And Spectral Manifestations Red was, funny enough, like terrible card the entire weekend. Same thing, because I like usually had a board.
You're just winning too much for these cards.
Yeah, I just keep drawing it. I'm like, dang it, I block with it. It blocks so many daggers and like things like that. I sunk it away a lot. I actually had some games where I was stacking it with like a Restless Coalesce, and I'd sink it away, and then I was gonna play Restless Coalesce, and like, this is only two, I just E strike it away, and now they're next to each other, never hit second cycle, of course. So I lose against Pete pretty quickly. Then I play against Dan Rakowski, and it's just like this game where he wins a dice roll, he makes me go first, I transcend on my first turn, then he goes, then I block a hat, I make a mirror guy. He has not transcended yet. I'm attacking a mirror guy. And the first thing, he's like size and block six on the mirror guy, because his hand is just a straight brick, like four cards. None of them have go again. He's just preserving life. I follow up with like, I don't remember, like a Phantasmoclasm or something. And then he looks at his hand. It's like a Levels and Ancestral Harmony. And I actually make a mistake. I let him keep the Ancestral Harmony and I bought him the Levels, because I'm like, oh, Levels is such a good card. But what I should have done is actually I should have bottom the Ancestral Harmony, because the only way he would have won, because he was so behind at that point, is by playing Ancestral Harmony and actually probably still blocking three with the other card, but then arseling Ancestral Harmony, and then next turn just luck sacking the Ancestral Harmony, because it's like such a good comeback card. Instead, he keeps the Ancestral Harmony, he blocks with the other card, which he ended up drawing another Ancestral Harmony, so it wouldn't have mattered. And the next turn, he plays Ancestral Harmony and banishes a chi card off the top. So it was just like basically into like penalty to card away. He got like two value from it. Like just things just went so in my favor. I got to keep Mirror Guy for another turn the next turn, which is just like that's just what's it called? It's unlawful. It's illegal. You can't let the.
I learned that term in law school. Illegal.
Illegal. Yeah. Ancestral Harmony. Man, it's just such a strong card. You're like, He bricked on it and it was still worth two. And it's like, card is like eight or nine or something.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
No, he bricked it. It was two. Which is like, two is not bad for your zero cost blue with go again.
Yeah, it was Black just, three, he needed to transcend. It helped him transcend. He ended up, I think, attacking him with Levels. And he told me if he had kept Levels, it would have been so much better. Because usually when you play the first Levels for two modes, you can play the other one for two modes. And it's just like, things go really well for you. And then I play against Andrew Lorenz. This is round 11. It's on stream. I do think, I want to say that if I don't commit the game's rule violation, that I would win. I would still have won, but it looks pretty egregious on stream. I feel pretty bad about it.
So before you dive into like the emotions, can you like explain what happened?
Yeah. So it's, I mean, up until when we get to this point, I think it's like turn six or seven. Andrew's just drawing bricks and bricks. Like the first turn of the game, he pitches a blue rune flash to attack me with a red rune flash. And this is, he had to go second. I won the dice roll. I decided to go first. And that's just not how you want to start Vizirai turns. Basically already telling me he has no non-attacks in this hand. And then after that, he goes, make a rune chant Rosetta Thorn. So like he just went three card seven. And that's basically how his draws felt like for most of that first half of the game, just like below rate Vizirai stuff, barely able to clear my ward. And then we get to this point in the game where he had just basically passed. He made a bunch of rune chants. I can't really remember exactly how he made rune chants. And it's my turn, and I'm like desperately trying to use my four card hands. And turn before, I had a choice between arseling a Miraging Metamorph or arseling a Phantasmoclasm. And I was like, dang it, why did I arsenal Phantasmoclasm? I should have arsenaled Miraging Metamorph when I draw my new hand. And I'm like planning out my hand, and it's I think it's like a Spectral Manifestations, a blue, I think it's two copies of Spectral Manifestations, a blue and a Coalescence, I want to say. And so my turn ends up being Spectral Manifestations, attack with it, Coalescence, attack with it, which was actually, I think, correct. I think that's what I was supposed to do. And then what I was supposed to do is pitch my last Spectral Manifestations to attack for one with my Spectral Shield. But instead, because I forget to tick down my resource when I attack with the Coalescence, I look at my resource count. I'm like, wait, I have a resource float. My tunic is up. And then I can pitch this last special manifestations to attack with Chasm. And so I just do it. I'm like, wow, this is amazing. I can't believe I didn't see this line because I was so frustrated out of Chasm in my arsenal. And then I do that, but it's illegal because I didn't pay the resource for the Restless Call lessons. And that's on me. That's honestly on me. I take full blame for it. Obviously, sure, there were dredges where it's also Andrew's responsibility to have me maintain the game state. But that's it, like, it looks really bad for me, and I also feel really badly about it. I will say by the time that game was seen, right, by everyone publicly, since we're on a delayed stream, it's already like happened. Like there's like, you can't undo, can't control Z that.
The game was over before Twitch chat ever saw that turn, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think it caught up by the top eight, I want to say. It caught up at some point during the day, but it's too late to fix that. I feel really bad about that. I think I'm doing some more content on that game particularly where I talk about basically a bunch of what ifs. Like, what if I played that properly? What if I did the line I just said, which is just pitch the other special manifestations red to attack for one, keep the Phantasmoplasm in my arsenal? Because the immediate next turn, he clears my board. And I actually do a Mirror Guy turn where if I have the tunic up with my Mirror Guy, because Mirror Guy basically functionally costs 4 resources, he costs 3 plus a resource to swing him, I have my tunic up so I can actually end with a Phantasmoplasm the next turn. I think it still yields a victory for me. The game just plays out slightly differently. Because my Phantasmoplasm ends up bottoming a red Malefic Incantations, which will never matter. He will never get all the counters from it because I'm just going to Mirror Guy him the next turn and basically kill him. But yeah, I felt really badly about that game. I think that is probably, if you were to ask me what my like scariest matchup from the meta decks is, it's definitely Vizirai. I think he was playing the more, if there's Sonata Galaxian in his deck, it's what we've been calling like the Noah Bagelman, the Runaways Vizirai, the more setup-y Vizirai, which is that way because some Enigmas are playing Sigil of Solace, maybe an Arcane Polarity to try to fatigue Vizirai. And if they're playing the more like Cheerios version, you actually do run the risk of getting fatigued. I think Brody was, I think he drew against an Enigma that was doing some type of strategy like that.
I think he conceded in one time.
Oh yeah, yeah. He did concede. Brody was a good guy. They went to time. But I mean, that was just like the fact that it got to that game state was telling. And I think we came up with like a better counter to that strategy just by being a little bit more aggressive. I do think Scar for Scar is a little sus in that matchup because obviously we're higher life total because they're setting up Rune Chance. But after they, you know, when they send that ninth blade, usually they are higher life total after that. So I think Scar looks good in those situations. I don't know. I just, things just don't, like, they didn't line up too well for me, but they were so poor for Andrew. Like, he was just not finding Mordreds. His first Revel was like so late into the game. He was so behind in life. And I just felt like so many things went in my favor. That game is kind of interesting. It's just the first 3 turns are your most powerful turns, I think, as Vizirai. I think winning the dice roll is really important as well. And basically none of those things happened. So ended up taking that. And then this brings us to round 12.
that was so my tournament was going pretty well as well. I was 9-2, ready for round 12. I'm like, man, I've been feeling really good about the deck. I think of my 2 losses, I think one of them I probably messed up pretty badly. I cracked my hat for basically 3 value, which you can get by just making a spectral shield with it. So
yeah.
I messed up one round pretty badly, and I'm feeling better, playing much better today. Round 12. The Michael Enigma Mirror.
Yeah, the Scar Enigma Mirror. I felt so sad, but it was like so bittersweet because we knew that meant one of us. We knew that Scar Enigma was going to make top 8 at the very least. We just didn't know which Michael would be piloting it. And I think I tell this story in the post-tournament interview, but obviously the day before, in that morning, you and I were looking at our list. We were like making our final like last cuts. And I'm looking at your list and I'm like, I think you got to play at least a second Ripple Away. Like, the first Ripple Away is just not enough. And I also don't really like blue Sink Below.
Yeah, I think it was more anti-blue Sink Below than pro 2 blue Ripple Away.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
What's the best blue if we're cutting a Sink Below for a 3 block? And it's clearly Ripple Away.
Yeah. And it's so sad because I own 3 non-foil and 3 foil Ripple Aways. And the day before, when I was packing, I was like, why would I need non-foil Ripple Away? I have 3 shiny ones. And of course, I'm sitting there telling you not to play Blue Sink Below, and I'm like, crap. The best thing I feel like you could play is a Ripple Away. So I just think about it for a while, and I'm like, you know what? I don't think it's that bad to play two Ripple Away. Actually, my Battle Hardened Hiroshima list only played two Ripple Away because that card does not spark joy for me. Like, when I draw that card, when I have to attack with that card, when I ponder into that card, for whatever reason, I just, like, I had an Azalea play Codex, and I looked at my card. No! Put the Ripple Away in there.
I'm pretty sure at least two times I have seen you activate the secret mode of Ripple Away, which is just discarding it, not to stop any tokens from being created, just to get it out of your hands so you don't intellect penalty a bad card.
Yeah, yeah. During Dash.io days, I remember we were playing against Brody, and Brody's attacking, I'm blocking, and you were watching me play, and you're like, why are you keeping Ripple Away as your last card? I'm like, look at this hand. All these other cards require you to keep another card to get them out of your deck, but the Ripple Away, it has that secret mode. And of course, Brody did that. I'm like, I have one card in hand, one card in arsenal, and Brody just goes, play a core, pass. And I'm like, aha, my turn. I will discard this Ripple Away, your turn.
Powerful.
So I give you that foil Ripple Away. You take out like a Sink Below. I ended up adding a blue Sink Below into my deck to replace it. And of course, the very first turn, and I joke about it too. And I was like, this is just a joke. There's just no way. And I'm like, if you discard that Ripple Away to my spectral manifestations, I swear. I did not follow up. It was a very toothless threat. But and it's like turn zero of the first turn of the game. I'm like, play spectral manifestations, and you just make that face. It's like. I don't remember exactly how to do it, but I'm like, no, not the foil one, please. And it was the foil Ripple Away. I think my main notes on that game are I popped Phantasmoclasm twice. I got so lucky. Or not, I triggered Phantasm twice. Yeah. I had a weakest link off the top of my deck on your Phantasmoclasm. So that was just pure numbers. Obviously, I don't think I had a board or anything. It's just like, I just saved so much life.
Plus points. Six life.
Yeah. And then later on, you had a Miraging Metamorph that I also had a popper for.
It was...
Enigma Chimera. Yeah.
The old blue 2/6.
Yep. Which was like just three more life again, or an extra card. And those both gave me like the life buffer I needed for our late game. Because we're like both playing the same way. We're playing what like a lot of experienced Enigmas are like, which is we're not really tied to our board. The moment our opponent keeps a 4 or 5 card hand, we're probably just going to fold the hand away because the downside of trying to protect and then losing your board anyway is so bad. We're just playing that game and our life totals just went straight down to the wire. I think it was a 1-1. It was like 1-2, like it was like super low life totals.
I think you were at 2 or 3 when you had the big restless board and I never did damage to you again after that.
Yeah. Whatever it was, it's just like, you know, a light feather would have ended our careers there. But
Yeah,
and I think we talked about it. You had that one turn with the Rage Spectre that maybe you should just block 6 and then send the Rage Spectre, peel some cards for me. Yeah,
my hand was 4 blues, no chi. Yep. My arsenal, I don't remember what my arsenal was. It wasn't anything that did anything. And
yeah.
I had 4 blues and you had a mirror guy with...
Just 2 counters.
2 counters.
Yeah.
And then you attacked with... You attacked with the mirror guy, and then you attacked with something else afterwards. I don't remember what it was. Maybe a weakest link, maybe
Something
for 6 or an E-strike.
Yeah, it's just something small. Something small.
And no, I'm pretty sure I could have blocked 6 that hand, so it couldn't have been
Not small, small, sorry. Something not like
that. I think it was Mirage Metamorph. Make you have to
block. Yeah. I think it was that.
Anyway, but I chose to play my blue Sink Below and try to find a card that could help clear your board rather than just block 6 and play the Rage Spectre and just accept that your mirror guy was going to live another turn. And
I
just used blue Sink, hit another unimpactful blue that didn't do anything. And I think it was probably better to just block 6 and play the Rage Spectre. But
yeah. Cause like both life total considerations. And also it's like when you're playing that blue Sink, you have to think about like, what could I actually hit here that actually would help? Any cheat card would probably help, to be honest. So maybe mathematically it was there, but you did not, and then it was really bad because you intellect penalty to card as well.
Yeah. Instead of gaining 6 life and intellect penalty, or and not intellect penalty a card, I basically blocked 2 instead of 6.
Yeah, so you took 4 extra damage.
Exact same.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that game, obviously, I ended up winning. And I think it's like, I don't know. I don't know if I played particularly well. I felt like drawing the weakest link off the top is just like sometimes... Like, we played, what, 5 poppers in that matchup?
Yeah.
I don't know. It was like a 1 in 20, maybe like a 4 or 5% chance that would happen.
I think If it's 5 out of 60 because your deck's untouched, it's like 1 in 12. So 8 or 9%.
Okay.
Not 5%. Way more likely than that.
Okay. Whatever it was, I felt very lucky. And I was like, little things like that. I mean, I feel like that's how a lot of tournaments end up getting won. It's just like you hit that 8 or 9% extra lucky factor, the critical strike factor, and you just roll those advantages. Don't make too many mistakes and just like sit on the luck and ride it through. So I make top 8. I looked at your standings. You made 11th, which is like makes sense, right, for winning in. Still not a bad showing at all, but obviously not top 8. I'm sorry about that game, but I'm actually really happy still that, like, you know, you ended up supporting me throughout. Like, you just like sat near me, and then like I would ask you questions, and then you would like give like really critical thinking, and we like started preparing the sideboard for Dash.io, and mainly New and Zen, because I was like pretty scared, and there was like some like last minute, especially for Blues, that we were like thinking about whether or not one of them in and out. Which spoiler, I ended up not even listening to in the finals, but
or the quarterfinals actually.
Yeah, quarterfinals I play against Dash.io, and you were like, I have to like kill him, and I was like, I played against 2 Dash.io's on Talishar this week too, and I just blocked, and then they ran out of cards, and I don't know. Hopefully, I could do it again, and I didn't have a race face then. I have a race face now. I feel like it has to be better, right? I don't know. I just got so lucky. I feel Thaminda is a really good player. I can tell he's very experienced with the deck. But I turn 0, play Spectral Manifestations, and I Astral Etchings it. And the next turn, he has a really bad turn. So I just start my next turn with 7 go again. And he has to activate Tekla Foundry Heart to actually clear my Spectral Shield. And he banishes 2 Spark of Geniuses. So the top card is a Spark, and he would really like to draw it. But he would also really not like to take 7 go again in the face again. So he ends up activating the Foundry Heart, and he banishes Spark, and the next card is another Spark, and that's just how the game went for me. He never resolved the Spark. He never played Cerebellum until like second cycle, it felt, because he was forced to pitch it. Basically, like that one little play from turn 0 changed how he wanted to play, because I mean, he was at 18 when I was at like 40, because he just is free taking all this damage. And it's funny because Dash.io plays like a pretty bad aggro deck when she doesn't have core Cerebellum. He had Pen Script in his deck. I don't know if he ported it against me, but when you don't have all these like augment, like item augmenters, you're actually just playing kind of just like a fair, like, you know, like leg tap into Surging Strike type of deck, especially when you're on Hanabi Blaster and you can't get the second or the second counter or the third boost card, which was like the structure of like 1-2 of his hands. I think it was like a Boom Grenade, a blue, and 2 boost cards. So you just like 5 go again into 5 is like all you're able to do, which I can deal with that. I can deal with that. That's how that game went. I think I fatigued him at 18. I was at 18. I was really mad because I think you were watching and I play a Restless Coalescence. I have a Spectral Spectral Shield with a counter, and I just like, yeah, your turn. And I'm like, why did I move the count? I don't understand.
Yeah, it's just minus 1 life.
It's minus 2 because it's minus 1. Yeah, it's minus 1. That's fine. I don't know what I was thinking. I was so mad. And because I did that, and then I was like kind of tilted. I misplayed the next hand. I have 2 sync blows in my next hand, which is insane because it's his like go-go turn. He's going to max V me with a Boom Grenade. And if I had blocked in my hat, got a chi, then sunk it away, and even gotten a 2 block, I would have been able to block out his max V. And not eating a Boom Grenade. But instead, I didn't block out either and ate a Boom Grenade and still fatigued him at 18. So really sad for me, but obviously I still won. I wasn't happy because I didn't play perfectly, but also it was like nice because I was like, I played this matchup twice in Talishar. I felt like in those games my opponent did some really, really good things. I got maxied 4 times in one of those games, and I still ended up fatiguing my opponent. Just because he took like a couple off turns and I built a board. Restless Coalescence was really good in those matchups. Just Astral Etchings it and just like making some counters on the setup turn, which is like what we used to do against Dash.io anyway, but much better in this meta because Dash.io's like average damage output so much less.
Yeah, I also credit a lot of that game to like you have a lot of experience playing Enigma. You were playing Enigma when Dio was at her top power, and you kind of know what you can do, what your fatigue math looks like. And if I was in your spot, I don't think I would have made the right decision. I definitely told you. I'm like, I think you might have to kill her. And you did not think you had to kill her. you blocked. And even with the mistakes that you said you made, you still ended at 18. So pretty clean fatigue victory.
Yeah. It felt pretty comfortable. But I think he low rolled pretty hard on his side. I think if we had played that and I had made that same mistake and he had drawn just a little bit better, played at least one or two sparks, I think probably I still would have won. But it would have been like 1-2 life total. Like, I think that matchup is on paper not that good. But I do think if the Enigma comes with a like plan of basically doing a degen fatigue and you don't stack, like he had another turn where he ended up having 4 cards in hand plus a card in arsenal. He just played pounder and passed because he realized I cannot keep trading cards and banishing top card of my deck like this. And I just like every time I felt like I punished him, that was a turn I attacked him with a race phase or something. And it was just like, he had to block and it was just not cool on his side. I was obviously happy to win. I was a little sad about my misplay and I was like, I really need to like get it together for the next game. And the moment that game finished, the judges came up to me and they're like, oh, your semifinal opponent is ready for you. I'm like, oh, what am I playing against? He's like, Tarek on Enigma. I'm like, no, like, I don't want to play Enigma here. Those are like the scariest. I feel like they feel so coin flippy with like, cause I played that mirror a lot at this point. And like, I've won games that I felt like just like, I don't know, my opponent just like didn't draw the right things. And I've lost games where my opponent has a mirror. I've lost a game where my opponent went mirror guy, double transcend, play mirror guy, astral etchings it, pass. And I look at my hand and I'm like, oh God, like, play Essence of Ancestry, stir the pot, make a shield, arsenal this really bad, like ripple away or something, your turn. And just like 10 go again. I'm like, not even 10, it's like 14 go again. I'm like, oh, I think I have lost the game. I can't kill it this turn either.
Yeah. I think Enigma is one of those heroes that can really, really high roll, but her high roll looks like a little bit different than like Zen in the past high roll, where her high roll is you put 10 plus power into play on the turn your opponent has a bad hand. And like every deck's going to draw a bad hand every now and then, maybe not every game, but it happens. Yeah. So those, and in the mirror, it's just like both sides have the chance to do that. And Enigma decks tend to be maybe a little clunkier than most aggro decks.
Our bad hands are way worse than our good hands, like the gap between them. My game against Tarek, I don't remember too many specifics. I think I misplayed from the dice roll. I chose to go first, which made no sense because his deck played more instants and he punishes me immediately by playing a Waning Vengeance, which that is like the least punishing thing that he could have played. If he played like a Waxing, would have been really badly off. His first turn with the Waning.
Maybe Restless would have been slightly less punishing, but.
Oh, yeah. Restless would have been, I'm trying to think. So I actually, he was playing Spears of Surreality plus Phantasmal Footsteps, and all three of his spears were like very good. They were just, what, like, he had a board, then he'd play spears, and I'm like, I have 2 poppers in my hand, and I do the math, and I'm like, I cannot actually block with either of them, because I have an E-Strike that I need to, like, in case I need to clear, I have to just keep the entire hand, so they all were 1 resource, 5 damage. But Scar was good, finally. That was probably the first time I attacked for Scar with Go Again in that entire tournament.
right, it was good. Most.
It was finally good. When I needed it most, it was just really, really good. Helped me clear one of his waxing boards, and another turn, I think I basically bluffed that I had a real hand and I just let a Scar and he let his board get cleared. And I felt like I was playing CYB new, because I was like, thank God, because I really don't got much after this. I got a Rage Spectre after this. That's it. Rage Spectre, your turn. Attack me. Like, Arsenal like a threat. That was how that game went for me. I think Scar's helped. He did not play Spectral Manifestations. He actually played kind of what I had in mind for the deck. He had Red Spears instead of Spectral Manifestations. I never drew Spectral Manifestations, but I was terrified because he had 3 Ripple Aways and I never saw any of them. I had one turn where I could have played Spectral Manifestations or I could have played Astral Etchings, but I would have to use my gloves and I just use Astral Etchings and I just pitched Spectral Manifestations. But that was like a really like good pivot turn for me. And then I just rode like a Restless Coalescence to victory from then on. That game was pretty close. And I think the main reason I won was actually not because of me, but because one of his hands was Mirror Guy, Mirror Guy, Mirror Guy. Titanium Bauble, and the hand's just really jank because like you have to arsenal Mirror Guy with that, but you have to pitch a Mirror Guy as well, and that's going to be the last Mirror Guy you probably play unless we go to second cycle or you stir the pot or whatever, because he had a block of Hat, so he's not shuffling the deck anymore. And he played Mirror Guy, and I had a Mirror Guy in my arsenal, so I just played my Mirror Guy, and then he played his second Mirror Guy, and I just Natty Drew into Mirror Guy with like double transcend. So it was just like I just felt like I just, that's just like as high roll as it gets, right? In that matchup, barely squeak it out. We actually go 1-1. That was our end life totals. But I started 1-1 with a Restless Coalescence of two counters, and I don't remember what else I had. It didn't matter.
Restless Coalescence with counters, very strong in
game
states.
Yeah.
Usually in any game state, but especially there, I guess.
Yeah. And then, the finals is on stream. I actually misplayed the first turn of the game. I should have activated my boots. I should have done anything. Basically, that Chi should never have been Sirens Called away. I'm not sure he should have Sirens Called there, Victor, in general. But it's like the first turn of the game, I double transcend. One of them is Drop in the Ocean, which I think is one of the highest high rolls you can do in that matchup. It's just dropping a dagger that this poor new just paid two resources to send at you, and you were just like, I just show you two cards. It's like I fuse with two chi and then just like put them back, and your dagger just like somehow just got nullified. He ends up Sirens Calling me on that turn, and if you watch it, I let one of my chis go when I could have just activated Enigma and then activated my boots and then showed him the Astral Etchings and played my next turn the same way. I ended up letting him draw a Scar for Scar into his arsenal, which he uses to very good use because he's basically never ahead on life the entire game. I do think that game does showcase sometimes that Enigma does run away with the game. The CYBs actually, I feel like, were a net positive for him. I think there's no other card in the game that would have let him do what he ended up doing, which is when I let the Mirror Guy with seven counters on it die to his Leave No Witnesses and he plays a CYB, obviously I look like a fool. I still think it was the correct thing to do, but like if you had like literally any other card besides like Sigil of Solace, you would have been so dead because he was at one when he goes Leave No Witnesses and he lets my Mirror Guy clears my Mirror Guy. Then he plays Red Count Your Blessings and goes to five. If he was at one, he's just dead the next turn because I have a special shield to go again. That's a card. Then I go Phantasmoclasm unless he draws a popper off the top. That's the rest of his hand, and it's my turn again. And I have an Astral Etchings in my arsenal for the next turn to like etchings the shield. So I think that was a good showcase of CYB just giving new like those like little edges here and there that don't intuitively make sense. Like you wouldn't think, and I never thought, especially when we played our first few games, that CYB would help the Enigma matchup. But after game two, I was like, I can totally see this being good. It's not purely good, but it just like lets you kind of play the game from a different angle.
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier to use what I believe is Nu's most common way of defeating Enigma, which is fatiguing her.
Yep.
When you have all this extra life gain, then you can take the damage from whatever attacks, clear the board, and then you have CYB to kind of regain a lot of that life back.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, the hero I think of when I think of CYB Nu, I actually think of Bolton, which is I knew you'd give that face, Roger, but it's because like in some sense both heroes are like storing resources for later, and life is the most important. Like there's no like in Flesh and Blood, life is cards, right? Like you pay life to keep cards. And by gaining life on the off turns when Enigma doesn't have a board, you are storing cards, potential of keeping cards on the turns that Enigma does build a board. So there's not that many heroes that can actually store resources like that. And Bolton's one of them. Every soul is at least one damage when you still have beacons. I'm just saying.
Enigma's pretty good at storing resources for future value. The resources just stay on board and kill your opponent.
That's true. But it's not like a permanent, uninteractable resource. Like life is like, the only way I can interact with it was by attacking you.
So you said that finals game was a bit of a runaway, but or a snowball. I don't remember exactly what you said, but yeah. It wasn't like what we usually see from Enigma snowballs, where like you play, like you talked about your earlier round against New, where you had a Restless that just stayed in play. Yeah. And you kept putting more counters on and you 40-0'd him. It wasn't like that. Your board got cleared like almost every turn. I don't know. There might've been one turn where you kept something in play, but it was like,
I think the very first turn of the game, I played a Rage Spectre and then I kept it around because I arsenaled the sink below. I kept around for one more turn. That's it. I immediately got cleared because he scarred first, scarred me the turn after. I think that's the only time I kept the board besides like the very, very late game when he was like basically having the block down and I had that Spectral Shield that had four counters on it because of the Astral Etchings. That was like the first time I'd like actually kept the board, and that's because his life total was so low. He had to block with all of the cards.
Yeah. So, and that was like kind of highlighting the strength of just like hitting him with Enigma.
Yeah, that's true. I think like when we played our test games, I never had Waxing Spectre in my list because I felt that Waxing was greedy, although it was really good in certain matchups. I was like, oh, I don't want it. And the main reason I didn't want it is because of Dash.io, I needed my deck to have a certain number of no blocks, and Waxing Spectre didn't make the list. And I was like trying to gear my deck to beat Dash.io, be able to fatigue Dash.io, and have like as few no blocks as possible. But basically once Dash.io's like dominance left the meta, it really opened up like the deck slots for Enigma, and playing Waxing that matchup feels so nice. And it's almost always I play it in response to Siren's Call. Like I have that turn where my hand is really bad because instead of taking out Erase Face and bringing in like any of the bad blue attacks that are kind of scary against Noob, I decided last minute, I was like, you know, Erase Face actually has text. If they have a Venomous Bite or a Hiss, Erase Face says you can't do it anymore. So I was like, let's keep them in. And I remember when I was like offering that idea to you, you're like, but aren't you just going to draw like all reds and it's just going to be like you'll die? And immediately the first time I draw an Erase Face, it's a four red hand with a Waxing Spectre. And I have a blue sink in my arsenal, and that's the turn I get CNC'd. And I'm just like, block of rare space, take two, lose my arsenal to blue sink. My turn is attack with scar for a scar for four, arsenal Waxing Spectre. But that was like, for me, like arsenaling Waxing Spectre feels like so good in that matchup.
Yeah.
Just because of, like, it lets you kind of get out of Siren's Calls, and like any of the arsenal destruction, just take it, play Waxing Spectre from arsenal. Yeah, and that Waxing Spectre ends up being pretty nice, but that's and the next turn I draw like a raised face with like four reds again, I was like, oh god. Yeah, that was Scar being nice too, because it was a one card hand. Like I mean, I don't know. If it was a yellow, it'd been really nice. It could have attacked a raised face. I don't know. Whatever the case. Ended up winning that game, obviously, that was insane. And I think for me, that calling run, I had so much good luck going my way. I think you always need that kind of luck in your favor. It's like you need happy, fortunate things going in your favor, and then you need to not mess it up by also like playing well and not making too many mistakes. And I feel like the combination of that is kind of what led to it. But I do think this was one of the tournaments where it felt more like my deck and the situations happening helped me win, and less so that like maybe me making too many like really good decisions helped me win. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think it does. I think that in general, if you're going to win a tournament with 400 people at it, you're going to have to get lucky at some points. But I also think you have to make the right decisions to like capitalize on that as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then having a good deck also helps.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to talk to you about is I remember last year you played a lot of Flesh and Blood. You traveled to like every calling last year. You did win the Pro Tour near the start of the year, not at the very start of the year, but whenever it happened.
Yeah.
But I remember you really wanted to win a Crown of Providence. And unfortunately, last year you didn't get it. And I think we all thought that you wouldn't have another opportunity to win it. So taking down the 50th calling, winning that gold foil Crown of Providence, what does that mean to you?
Oh my gosh. It meant so much. I think I definitely started that weekend with like absolute no expectations. I've been to the other 15 or whatever callings outside of the ones that are attached to the majors, where Crown of Providence was potentially there. Like literally every single possible one that I could go to outside of the ones that were attached to majors, I participated in, and I did not win one. And I had already kind of gotten over it, you know, like it was a dream of last year. And I basically never thought about that at all until the finals. It just was like, someone else has always been winning. I already won the Pro Tour. I've won a bunch of things. Like, I don't need to win again. It's like, I already used all the luck I feel like I need in my Flesh and Blood career. But when it actually happened and when I was actually presented with it, I felt really emotional because, like, I had made that goal. And I still remember when Yanji and I were playing this game 3 years ago in 2021. And I was like, I told him, I showed him what a black, Black Lotus, what a gold foil tunic looked like. And I was like, we got to win one of these. Like, this is literally like Alpha Black Lotus status. Like, we got to win one of these. We got to really work hard. And we ended up both winning one at some point later on within a calendar year. And it was like so cool because it's like, that is just like a piece of Flesh and Blood history that to me is like the most important. And it's like, because I checked that box, I was like, I really want to win a Crown of Providence now. And we were talking earlier last year, I think in January, we were talking about our goals. And I was like, that's my goal. Like, my goal is to win a gold foil Crown of Providence. I think it'd be really cool to get one of these. And I just like, I had multiple, I basically top eighted three callings and I did not get there any time. I lost in the quarters twice, in the semis once. And I just couldn't get there. And to have just gotten this opportunity to win at the 50th was just like amazing. Like, I think, I didn't really believe it, to be honest. I just was like kind of incredulous. I did something that I only am doing nowadays because of you, Michael. The first time you and I roomed for World Championships, the one that you ultimately won San Jose? Like, we roomed together at the Hyatt. You called Casey like every night. And I thought that was really cool. I actually admired you a lot for it. I thought highly of you for it, because it's so hard for me to think of Leslie or my wife while we're in tournament mode. And the fact that you, like, it was very intentional. Like, it wasn't like we were just like literally downtime. Like, we were talking, you're like, I think I'm gonna call Casey, is that okay? I had a lot of respect for you for that, and I ended up calling Leslie that night. And I was like, you know, I was just like talking to her, I was very emotional. But I thought about like you, how you did that even before you became a world champion. You just like took time to just check in with the people that you love and you care about, and that was cool. That was cool. I have a lot of respect for that.
Thank you. I am glad that it makes me happy whenever something that is important to me, that other people either appreciate it or use it to do things that are important to them too.
That's really cool. Yeah. Roger also does that too, by the way. He also calls his wife and video calls with this kid. But like the first time I saw that in action, and that was meaningful to me because like all three of us obviously have SOs and life partners. But until then, like, I've been rooming with Brody a lot. I've been rooming with like people who are a lot younger and at different stages of their lives, and they don't have that like responsibility or that person that they call and check in with. And I think that's the coolest thing about Flesh and Blood is like a lot of us are former like ex Magic grinders. Like, I was one. I never did well, but we've had that young phase, and now we're all like getting older.
Now we're old. Mature. We're just old.
And I think it's now. Just cool, right? Like, we're still playing this tabletop game where you have to like meet a bunch of people. But we have like this level of maturity that I really, really appreciate. I think it's like, it's good. We can be good role models for others as well. It just shows that like, you know, you can be a really good Flesh and Blood player, a really good TCG player, and still be able to have these meaningful relationships outside of that, with both like having a kid or having like a life partner. So I want to continue to do that and just be a good example of that. And so I thought, and Michael was the first time I saw that.
Yeah, I'm bringing Angela and Austin with me to Chicago, where since it's in, I think the tournament's in the same thing as the, I get to do the bring wife and kid to the hotel with me. So that's
good. Yeah. I think it's going to be great. The fact that it's close, it's in the same venue.
Yeah, I think earlier this week, I'm like, Roger, what are you doing for Chicago? I don't know how I'm getting up there yet. I haven't figured everything out. He's like, you're on your own. I'm going with Austin and Angela. Sounds good. All right. I have one more question for you. It's a whole other topic but a small little sidebar before we wrap up the podcast. So
I know what it is.
There is a player of the year race that was announced. Okay. I think it was announced at Worlds. It was announced very recently.
Yeah.
And you are currently in first place on the player of the year race. Is that something that you're striving to win or compete in this year?
Absolutely. I think that changed a lot of my plans. I wasn't planning on going to Kuala Lumpur or Florence callings just because I, you know, this year has not been the best for me until that calling win. I think someone mapped it out and said, like, if 2023 used the same, retroactively gave up World Tour points, Brody would be at like 96, 3, something like that. Like some outrageous number closer to 100 than anything else. And I would be at like 30 something. And there would be a lot of people in between, in the 40s, in the 50s. Anyone that, basically all the people that won a Pro Tour or Worlds, because those are worth like 28, 32 points, like they'd immediately be in the scoreboard. And that's kind of how this year has felt. It's been not the best year. I've had some, I won a couple Battle Hardens, but I got like 33rd at Amsterdam and like 68th at Osaka. Like, it's just not, I've usually, like, my goal has always been top 32 at these tier fours. And I just, honestly, if I had played perfectly and just had bad variance, I would have felt better. But I also did not play perfectly. I had made mistakes and I felt pretty bad about my year from an organized play perspective. And I wasn't going to go. But then when the World Tour kind of got announced, I was like, well, that's like one more thing to strive for. Like, and it's kind of like a clean slate, you know, like my year up until now hasn't been very good. But now I have this clean slate of like, we're all at zero again. Thank God, because I'd been 60 points behind Brody otherwise. And I was like, I really want to give it my all and really try. I think I keep saying this, right? And Roger keeps calling me out on this. But I think like this next year through Worlds might be kind of the last year I have.
Three years in a row I've been hearing this story.
Well, okay, but actually, because we're moving. We're planning on moving sometime late next year. We don't know when. We're buying a home that hasn't been built yet, so they have to build it first. And we're planning on moving down to, me and Leslie are planning on move to Virginia and maybe start a family down the road. But like, this would be kind of the last year. Okay, maybe if we started late enough, maybe next year. But like, I'm pretty sure this is the last full year that I have.
But like, even I think I proved that, like, sure, maybe you can't jet set around the world 100% of the time you're doing now. Like, you can still like squeeze in, I think I play a reasonable amount of tournaments.
Yeah, I can imagine like a calling or two, but definitely like no international callings and none of these domestic battle hardens. And I think that's like, that's fine. I just...
I went to an international calling.
Right. But you really wanted to go. I remember when you were talking about that. Yeah. So that's kind of like my thought process is like, yeah, the World Tour for this year is going to be really cool. I really want to pursue it. I know that Brody's going to be breathing down my neck. Like right now I'm ahead of him, but like, God, all it takes is like literally like one event. Brody's been on a tear. Like he has made top eight at basically every event he has made this entire year, except for the tier fours. I actually am struggling to think of events that he didn't make top eight at. He also won a calling this year. Like he's just been on an insane run. And, I think he's like lifetime, like 33 PTIs earned. Like, it's just like his meteoric rise is just like, it's so, we take it for granted, but it's like insane. And so I know it's gonna be stiff competition, but I think it's gonna be great. It's gonna be a good competition. It's gonna be cool. I know that there's like pretty controversial opinions about the World Tour, the rich get richer, like those vibes, and like maybe try to cap it at like only four or five like of your best events. I think right now as it stands, it encourages me and Brody at least to go to like basically every event. I don't know how many other people it encourages to do that. And maybe that's not great. Maybe that's not what the system is designed for. At least that's what it's doing right now. It's encouraging us to kind of really get out there. Like I took a break in August this year. I didn't go to Calling Manila. I didn't go to another Battle Harden. And it was really good for me. That 1 month was like, I got a lot of really good rest. But I don't think I would do that next year if it was the same because of the World Tour.
So. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. I do think what you said about potentially it being capped could make sense. I know Magic, which is my original like big competitive game, they said you could count your six best Grand Prix finishes, which their Grand Prix are like our callings. So
yep. And that was for your like Pro Tour player points or something like that.
Yeah. And something like that I think might be a good change, because it's still like you're still encouraged to go to every calling until you've got six firsts or whatever.
So
we'll see what they do, but I'm excited to hear that you are very excited about playing the game again. I shouldn't say again. I feel like
I think like you and I both did not like the PT Amsterdam meta. Like I did not really enjoy losing to Zen while I was at like 30 life and then I was at zero. I think that was like kind of a sad time for us as competitive players because we had to like live through that. You know, it's over now. I think like basically without all these like really high offensive output decks, it's been kind of a fresh change for me. And it's probably one of the reasons why Enigma has been doing so well, because that was one of the best ways to counter Enigma. Just have a deck that just like vomits so much damage. Like it just makes so many of the other turns non-consequential. Although that was like a good strategy against anybody, but like against Enigma, because of the nature of our, like, we're trying to build a board, whatever. I think the meta's in a better spot. It's going to be interesting. Jarl's coming out literally like today. We'll see what that does. I'm pretty excited to continue playing though, because of all these changes. It's made the game feel just a little bit back to like the amount of variance in the game has felt like it has swung back to less variance. And like you have more opportunity to express skill, and it's, and also more opportunity to express like deck build decisions, which I felt like were negated a lot more when you were just dying in one turn.
Yeah. I think a quote that I saw floating around on social media with people kind of expressing frustration for whatever reason in this current meta was that people were saying that when MST was first announced or whatever, they thought Enigma was the most fair illusionist they have ever printed. And that's true, because when Zen and when they were ramping up these decks to vomit all that damage pre-tome banning, basically when they were most heavily testing Enigma, I imagine in their internal testing, Enigma wasn't very good, or was very good in some very particular decks. But like you said, if your opponent's vomiting 30, 40 damage in a turn, then like who cares about the ward? But when they banned the tomes and slowed the meta down, then Enigma gets a lot more powerful in that kind of situation like you're talking about. But obviously that wasn't their initial intentions when they were designing the set.
Yeah. It's funny because I think Prism 2 and Enigma actually had some similar play patterns in the case that both heroes wanted to use their hat to create these like 4 or 5 card hands, like Prism 2 with Halo plus like Tome of Divinity, and then just like overwhelm from there. But that is no longer possible from Prism 2. Prism 2 is now like a really sad glorified Herald aggro deck. But Enigma still has kind of retained that identity of being able to use hat to pivot, or use hat to like just play 5 cards plus arsenal into opponent. And I think that's like something that they probably wanted to happen, but at this point it's starting to become like pretty oppressive play from both heroes, honestly, from Zen and Enigma. But because Zen has lost so many of his tools to make it really powerful, it just feels like Enigma is the biggest winner and actually the best user of Traversal Universe. And it's no longer Zen. That's how I truly feel. Because I played Zen at a couple of ProQuests because I didn't want to play Enigma Mirrors. I was kind of scared. And I was playing a lot of Zen, and I realized Zen has some weaknesses too. And I think that's how I ultimately ended up just being Enigma guy.
Makes sense. Yeah, touching on what you said about lower variance too, I'm trying to think of all the games I've lost since the book bannings. And basically every single game I can point to a play that maybe I should have done something different. And a lot of the games that I lost, there's like a for sure turn that I almost certainly should have done something different. I'm not saying that that would change the outcome of every game, but a lot of these games are close. And if you're making mistakes, then it's great to be losing games because of mistakes and not just losing games because Zen's doing 35 damage to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I lost some games to High Octane after the book bans. In fact, I lost 3 games at the Worlds. One of them was definitely, I could have played better, but 2 of them were just like, you got me. Like, yeah, I'm going to shoot you pistol 6 more times. System reset. High Octane, yep. Got it. You got it. I'm dead. Okay, you got it. I was like, yeah, we banned the books, but then there's like a lot of offensive overlap from the Dash AO deck. And then once I banned High Octane, like, I have really not felt that way. Like, I feel like all of my games have been, I can make decisions. And I know that I have said Enigma is not very good for a really long time, but I've done a lot of soul searching. And basically that spiel about Enigma being the better Traverse user, which I don't think everyone will agree with me, but it's just something I've started to internalize more. Because I'm like, how am I winning? Like, I keep winning these games and I'm like, I don't understand. Like, these are supposed to be bad matchups, right? Like Zen in particular. And I'm just thinking about it. And I'm like, I just think that like already from a Mystic standpoint, the Mystic heroes are playing all these blues. So we don't have these all red hands that are like kind of really bad for almost every other hero. we have that a lot less because we're just playing so many blues. We're intending on attacking some of these blues. So our all blue hands are sometimes some of our best hands, which is incredible, right? Like I think Wyatt posted his IRA list. I played it for the first time. I drew four blues. I basically pressed main menu, conceded immediately. I was like, these all attack for one. I'm gonna have to arsenal one of these. I don't want to play anymore.
Yeah, I think that the power of Traverse and Enigma, it makes a lot of sense. And like the big powerful turns, like you combine a Chi and Mirror Guy and any form of disruption, and that hand's broken. But like to do that, you only need the Mirror Guy and the disruption piece, and then the hat covers the Chi, and then you just need to draw one more blue, and your deck is like all blue. So it's very easy to put that hand together.
Any final thoughts, Michael or Michael, before you wrap things up then?
Michael, I really appreciate you. Thank you for just always, I don't know, being a great friend. I also, your mom commented on my Facebook post and it was really, really touching. I think it's really cool. I think a lot of good players in this game, we are surrounded by people who love us and care for us. I felt that especially when I was in Baltimore. It's like hard to take it for granted, but you know, Thanksgiving was yesterday and there's like so much to be thankful for because we have, like you and I, Michael, and also Roger, we all are quite privileged. We are comfortable enough to be able to travel. We have the time, we have the resources. Mm-hmm. We are able to, you know, do this testing or not, or just like kind of talk through our game plans. We are like so blessed in so many ways. And I think like the one thing I really want to talk about or just give thanks to is just how lucky we are that we were able to do this. How lucky we are that after Worlds, we have another calling to play and try our ideas. And so I guess if that's something I want to end on is just like, we are so lucky and let's not take this for granted.
True.
Yeah, that's very true. The community in this game is amazing. I think there's just a lot of great people and it is a lot to be thankful for. I agree.
We are loved. Thank you for loving us, and we will try our best to pay it forward. Yeah.
Okay. Well, one more thanks. Thank you, Michael, for coming on the podcast and talking through your call. Appreciate it a lot.
Yeah, of course. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And the next time you're being thankful for the people and events in your life, always remember Mighty Manners. Thanks for watching.